Welcome to The Near Memo, a weekly conversation about search, social, and commerce. What happened, why it matters, and the implications for local.
Hi, everybody. This is episode 130, believe it or not, of The Near Memo. This week, we're all back together. The band is back together. And we are going to be talking about Google using clicks, behavioral signals in search rankings, which was a very hot topic over the course of the last week or so. We're going to be talking about Google's review fraud detection and its kind of honesty or dishonesty about what it does. And then finally, ChatGPT and Bard plugins and what that suggests about the future of search, or one branch of the future of search. So, David, why don't you tell us, I mean, everybody sort of knows this issue already, but for years, Google denied that behavioral signals and clicks in particular had any impact on rankings. And lo and behold, the trial reveals that that was not true.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously Google's been fighting tooth and nail in all of these, with all of these motions to try not to have to disclose this stuff, or at the very least disclose it behind some sort of legal veil of secrecy. And they've failed in many cases to do so. I don't know to what extent this, the fact that they had to admit that they do use clicks in terms of determining rankings, like, I don't know how much that is a trade secret among other people who are trying to build search engines. I think that that seems, to me, it seems to have been a pretty obvious ranking signal for quite some time. And it's also a very logical ranking signal in terms of, at the very least, you know, sort of testing results, you know, that you cycle into people's top three or top six or top eight, and then sort of testing the click-through rate to see if that's a better result than the one that was there previously. I mean, it just, it's like a best practice in terms of user experience. So I don't think it's sort of totally earth-shattering in terms of being a trade secret, but it just, again, it's just one more instance of Google, in previous statements, Google potentially either being duplicitous or so narrowly defining the scope of their answer that it actually is misleading to people who are hearing that answer. And we saw this also with, which we talked about a few weeks ago on the podcast, in terms of Google's advice not to prune content that isn't getting any views. You know, again, that's just not good SEO advice. And so I think it's something that those of us who have been in the space for quite a while, you know, have kind of learned to, at the very least, take everything Google says with a grain of salt and, you know, at worst, understand that they are saying these things for self-motivational purposes, and that you just have to do your own research and look at the results that your clients are dealing with and try to interpret why those things are there. In many cases, if there's not a discernible reason that a business with a weaker link profile or a weaker review profile or whatever is there, it's possible that clicks explain a huge chunk of that. And that's one of the reasons that back in the day when I was still running the local search ranking factors report, like, that's really a big reason that I added the sort of behavioral signals category, is that it sort of, it explains a lot of the variance in terms of being a much more of a black box than these very obvious, you know, sort of empirically observable signals are. So,
yeah, this information came out, I think, in documents that were presented to witnesses, either for their explanation or in some cases, maybe upon cross-examination. And so this was all, as lawyers say, memorialized in documents, and then the witnesses had to comment on it, and they couldn't really contradict what the documents said, and the documents were pretty explicit. And you know what was interesting to me, and this is a little bit of a digression away from the SEO angle, is that this whole issue came out because the allegation is that Google needed these default search deals in order to amass this click data, which would then give them advantages versus rivals in terms of search quality. And so that's sort of the context in which it was discussed at the trial, I think.
And I would argue that there's another angle here, which I haven't seen discussed, but it's been a theory for a long time, is that one of the things that drives rankings is sort of co-occurring brand searches with a sort of category keyword, right? So if you have like, you know, REI hiking boots, then REI ranks very well for the hiking boots keyword as well. And in order for that signal to work, you also need to amass a huge amount of users and a huge amount of data, you know, to the same, so the same comment about, you know, how these deals sort of reinforce Google's market position. So I think brand signals are another, you know, again, sort of pretty obvious ranking factor to those of us who have been in SEO for a long time that are significantly influenced by the size of data that Google has access to. And, you know, I don't recall if Google has ever commented publicly on that, but it's another area of this trial that I think should be getting some attention. So
it's not unlike quality raters in a certain way, or training a large language model, you know, where you need that feedback loop in order to refine the results.
Which they've done in spades now with various AI implementations in search. I don't even remember all the names of these things, but certainly
BERT and MUM and RankBrain. Right. And
yes. We'll have to get Marie Haynes on as a guest. She seems to be the ultimate chronicler of these things. So,
right.
Well, and the testimony also in the trial was that, you know, Google relied very heavily on these click and behavioral signals in the past, but now with AI, they need less and less user data. Now that I guess these models are trained, they need less and less user data in order to do ranking. So the implication is that they're moving away from
they only need 3 months of data rather than right. 3 years of data now, right? That's so they agreed to throw it away after 3 months, right?
Well, it'll be,
and also the data is going to be very personalized. You know, Greg, you and I had an offline discussion several months ago in terms when I was testing Bard as soon as it came out, and you know, it was very clearly using my search history to give me results for categories that I was searching in again. And I think that that's, you know, Mike, to your point, like they don't need maybe the sort of horizontal level of search data that they needed previously. But the longer you've been a Google user and the more addicted to Google you've been, probably the better your results are going to be. So there is a sort of entrenchment advantage there as well. So.
Right. So let's move on to Google's review fraud detection commentary. The FTC is in the process of formulating a rule against fake, you know, review fraud endorsements, testimonials, which will allow them to more aggressively go after fraudsters and impose civil penalties. And the comment period, I believe, now is over. I think it was over at the end of it's. I think it's this week that it ends. But they basically had almost a year to submit comments, and TripAdvisor and Yelp and the National Association of Auto Dealers and a bunch of individuals did. And you can go to the FTC site, which I linked to from one of the newsletters this week, and you can just look at all those comments. And I thought the Google one was pretty interesting. Mike, what did you take away from it?
So it was broken out into three sections. The first one was titled, Google Has the Will. This is Google's response, has the will and incentive to combat fake reviews. And they referenced statements that some platforms that the FTC made, that some platforms may have mixed incentives to deal effectively with the problematic reviews. And despite some platforms purporting to take enforcement of problematic reviews seriously, fake and deceptive reviews continue to flourish on those very platforms. And Google said, we respectfully disagree, right? So, and they went on to say all the right words about how, you know, fake reviews violate a consumer and business trust and they can't abide by that. But if you look at the history, that's clearly not the case. I mean, they allowed fake and reviews to flourish from 2008, at least until 2022. How many years is that? 14 years. And they did nothing about it. So I would say that it's not so much they have a financial incentive to turn a blind eye. It's more that more of a passive thing. They just didn't want to expend the resources because they had no relevant right. income from it. So in part two, they talk about the substantial work to combat fake reviews, and they use their terms of service as proof of this, right? For example, reviews must be based on real experiences and information. Now, there, which is interesting, is they don't enforce that in any objective real-world way. They only enforce it insofar as they can see either in the review itself or in the metadata. But they will take no external proof. Like if an employee, ex-employee leaves a review and you have proof that it's an ex-employee, for example, Google will not accept that as a reason to take the review down. So yeah, they have these rules, but if they don't have a successful algorithm to reflect them, what the hell difference does that make? And then in the third part, they talk about our work to combat, this is the title of it, our work to combat fake reviews has been effective. We're committed to doing more to address this problem. They go on to say in 2021, which is interesting because 2022, I think they took down more fake reviews than 2021, but you pointed out that that could be because there were so many fake reviews that came up early in the pandemic. But in 2021, users submitted around 1 billion map reviews, and we blocked or removed 95 million of them, and then they removed another million from user reports. So almost 10% of the reviews were removed. And then it went on to say, and this is the one that burns my ass, is our data shows that the amount of content seen by users on maps that is fraudulent or abusive is less than 1% of all the content viewed on maps. Now, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean that reviews?
It means I did not have sex with that woman.
It's like such a bogus statement because there's so much content on Google Maps, Q&A, posts, photos, you know, hours, website links, all this stuff that they could count as interactions. And so the review interactions were 1%. 1% is, it's a meaningless number. And so the other thing I took away from this was just the passive voice, the sort of third party excuse, right? Businesses, this is a quote from Google, businesses may also have strong incentives to buy positive reviews, which exacerbates the problem, right? Well, who created these incentives in the first place, right? It was Google. I mean, they built this system that created a marketplace around fake reviews, took no responsibility for it for 14 years, and then they blame the businesses for taking advantage of this. It's just, that's crazy. And then they talk about the same thing with third-party reviews. Oh, we allow third-party reviews. We have no quality control over those. It could be, they could be bad. Well, who allowed them, right? So there's, It is one of these totally disingenuous statements that sort of says, blame the buyers and sellers of reviews, but don't blame the systemic causes of them. And at the end, they say, you know, that's essentially what they say, is that they should, that the FTC should be focusing on the bad actors perpetuating fake reviews, not the platforms working hard to stop them.
That was a very, that was a very sort of, we're the victim, you know, we're not the
right.
The perpetrator.
Exactly. It's this whole passive thing where they create a system that doesn't work, and then everybody's to blame. The internet, the bad actors, whatever. It's just, are they that not in touch with reality, or this is just the spin that they put on it?
Well, it's spin. I mean.
Go ahead, Greg.
Well, so I feel compelled to explain my joke. Bill Clinton said that about Monica Lewinsky, and he used the word sex. You didn't get the joke. He used the word sex very carefully. He defined it as, you know, sexual intercourse and not other stuff, when he was, of course, guilty of other stuff. So he was technically correct, perhaps, but still misrepresenting what had gone on. And this is what Google is doing with the word content. They're defining, you know, the people would infer from that word that they're talking about reviews, the review corpus, the total of the percentage of total reviews that are fraudulent. But as you correctly point out, they're talking about anything and everything that might be on a profile. So it's a sort of a technicality and a misdirection a little bit. And you know, the 1% number I think is significant because it seems to be a psychologically acceptable number. Right. A legally acceptable number. Amazon says the identical thing. Only 1% of the reviews are ever, you know, that are seen by customers are inauthentic or suspicious or whatever. They're saying the identical thing, and they may have even chosen that number to match the publicly stated Amazon number, because people can say 1%, that's tiny, that's not meaningful. You know, sure, we have to allow for some amount of error, and that's a socially acceptable amount.
Yeah, they don't go on to say that 99% in locksmiths are fake reviews, or 80% in moving companies are fake reviews. 1% of all content is fake or seen. They don't even say it's fake. That's compared to all the content. They say that's what's seen, right?
Right.
So it's a percentage of what's seen. So it's a number that is just so totally meaningless. That
as we learned in our own user research, like very few people actually read reviews, right? But the fake reviews are very clearly playing a role in the ratings that everyone is seeing right. all the time. So
right. Yes. So that those strong incentives that businesses have to buy positive reviews are exacerbate the problem that poor Google has, right?
Well,
we need the world's tiniest fiddle here, Mike, for this portion.
There you go.
In the transparency company Uberall report that I worked on with Curtis Boyd a couple of years ago, where we compared Google, TripAdvisor, Facebook, and Yelp, you know, about 10.7% of Google had the most fake reviews across the board horizontally. We looked at 19 categories, business categories. Google had 10.7%. I think Yelp was second, then Facebook, and then TripAdvisor in terms of declining the percentage of fake reviews. And in some of those categories, right? So the average is 10.7, and we were very conservative in coming up with that. There were certain categories like movers and locksmiths and others that were way above 10%, into the 20s. And so, you know, I think it's very, very clear that the 1% number is completely bogus. Those numbers may have changed with Google's stronger enforcement in the recent past, but.
I think it goes back to our first conversation. The number is accurate. We just don't know what it means. It's 1% of all content viewed on maps. What does that mean? It's just a meaningless number, right? This goes back to the
right.
first conversation where Google couches these in definitions that we have no right. idea what they're referring to.
Right. Well, okay. Once again, to return to Google. Last week, I guess it was, Google rolled out the first of its plugins, what it calls extensions for Bard. It announced them at Google I.O., the developer conference. And they rolled out a bunch of extensions, which are content applications, tools that now become part of Bard's results. They didn't. They promised a bunch of third-party tools like Kayak and OpenTable and several others, a bunch of others actually. And what they initially rolled out, which makes a certain amount of sense, is Google-specific tools, so Google Flights, Hotels, Maps, Workspace, and YouTube, meaning that once you do a query on Bard, you'll get results that encompass those other sources. And I think this is, and ChatGPT has plugins, sort of a similar kind of approach, although I don't know whether they've suspended them or what precisely. I'm not able to access any of those today.
Complicated setup.
Maybe I'm just, the settings are wrong. But what's fascinating to me, whether it's ChatGPT or Bard, is that if you have enough of these and enough domains, you've got the ability to construct, and you can choose them. You can turn them on and off, which is what Google has set up. They allow you to turn individual applications on and off. You can build a custom search engine, which to me is really a fascinating possibility. You can build a custom search engine, which would allow you, for example, to do travel planning using only selected tools. So Kayak, Expedia, Google Flights, Google Hotels, Hotels.com, and get results that are structured and more or less vetted, more or less, and free of all the spam and the noise that you get if you're just doing a traditional Google search. And I think that this has really opened the door to some fascinating possibilities, which we don't know if they're going to develop. But this is, I was saying in the green room, that this was sort of a version of what Siri wanted to build before Apple bought it. It wanted to bypass Google entirely and connect directly to vertical sources and search engines and tools that would give you an answer based on your query or your prompt from those sources. And so you didn't need to go through Google, or Google didn't have to be a gatekeeper in that situation. So I think it's really a fascinating, fascinating development. We'll see what happens with it.
It speaks to how they're planning on Bard being used, which is integrated into their productivity apps, which I think is interesting because it's essentially extending all of their search knowledge into docs and sheets and slides and mail and all those places. And it does well at these sort of combined queries. Like I tested it. I went to Isla Mujeres last week and I tested it. And I said, you know, what are the best flights? What are the best hotels? What are the best restaurants? What should I be doing in a query? And it, then developed an answer to that. And to some extent, this is how you keep some of the lying out of AI, is by giving it a structured knowledge graph to look at from which to extract its answers. Although still 1% of all the content is, might contain fake reviews. You're on mute, Greg. You know that, right? And David, you're on mute.
I do, because I had somebody come to my door and my dog went berserk. So I was trying to mitigate that.
Well, so, you did a good job.
A relatively good job, but not entirely.
Better than my coughing spasm.
Yes, well, we're human beings. That's what this reveals. You get the unvarnished reality of our life experience here. I mean, I think there are a lot of other things to say. I mean, one of the things to talk about in the future is ChatGPT's integration of voice, human-sounding voices, and the ability to interact in a very conversational way with the mobile app, at least. I think that's also a really fascinating development that puts a certain amount of pressure on Bard. I mean, you know, what ChatGPT is trying to do is very similar to what Google Assistant promised to be but never became. So I think that's also really fascinating. There's definitely a lot going on, and I think that even though Google seems to have kind of blunted the threat from these chatbots or these chat tools in the short term, I think in the long term it hasn't entirely eliminated them.
It does seem to me that Bard strategy makes more sense than SGE, which seems to me a hot mess. SGE like comes and goes from local. It's got all these crazy carousels and in local. It just doesn't seem like a very workable solution. And one wonders exactly what role it has long haul in this context. I mean, we know they're using AI to inform results now. I mean, do they really need SGE? Does it make the results any better? And will it stay?
Well, I mean, we're sort of going over a little bit, but it was a product designed to answer, you know, Bing, basically, I think. And it was a way to integrate this capability into traditional search results display. And so I think that they created because they felt compelled to, and they still don't really know exactly what to do with it, I think. So anyway, all right. On that note, that note of uncertainty or anticipation, we will end another triumphant discussion of search, social, and commerce at the Near Memo. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we appreciate your attention and your feedback.
Thanks for joining David, Mike, and Greg. To stay on top of the latest developments in local, subscribe to our newsletter at nearmedia.co. We'll see you next week.